Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Sunday's Super Bowl pits two extraordinary teams against one another, one driven by unquestionable star power of its quarterback, the other by its combination of a lethal run and a relentless defense. We're spending the next hour on the prowess of star players at the game, new ways of winning, the state of the game, and a look at a pair of teams that share a long history in the NFL and an insatiable appetite for this trophy. This hour, On Point, everything you need to know about Super Bowl 54. We're going to lead off with legendary broadcaster Al Michaels. He's the play-by-play voice for NBC's Sunday Night Football. He's called 10 Super Bowls for network television. 10. Al Michaels, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, David. Looking forward to a good one this Sunday for sure.
So as I mentioned, you've called 10 Super Bowls for network television. I wanted to play just a few for our listeners to remind them a little bit of what it sounds like when you're in the booth. Here we go.
Pass is intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler. Unreal.
Uh-oh.
Brady gets hit. The ball is out. And Philadelphia has it. Derek Barnett comes away with it. And indeed, they looked upstairs. They confirm it is a fumble. And the Pittsburgh Steelers become the first franchise in history to win 6 Super Bowls.
Only Pat Summerall of CBS has called more Super Bowls, 11, as a play-by-play announcer. NBC is next set to broadcast Super Bowl in 2022. Are we going to hear you there, Al?
I hope so. Yeah, you know, good Lord willing, and you know, stay healthy. And I do plan to be there when the game is going to be played in Los Angeles, my hometown.
All right, well, make sure to stretch first. So what makes, you've called a lot of sports over the years. What makes calling a Super Bowl unique?
Well, you understand that it's a national holiday, in effect. I mean, it's an unofficial holiday, of course, but you know that most of the country is watching, or a good percentage of the folks around the United States are watching, and around the world as well. So it's special. It's exciting. The lead-up to it is great. And then once you get there, I know in calling these games, I've always felt that it's one of the easier games to call because people have been inundated for a couple of weeks with all of the stories leading up to it, the sidebars, the human interest stories. So once you get going, it's the game itself. And hopefully the game is good. I know I've called, as you say, 10 of them, and 6 of them have gone down to the end.
Huh.
So I've been lucky. A few of them have not gone to the end. In fact, when I did the 49ers against San Diego in Miami 25 years ago, that was route. So then you go into your saddlebags, you try to tell a few stories to keep people interested. But there's nothing like a game that goes right down to the finish.
What would you look for as a broadcaster? Your colleagues over at Fox are handling this one. But what would you look for as a broadcaster sizing up this game? What narratives, surprises, what elements would you try to tease out?
Well, I think, you know you've got two great offenses, and they're very different because, you know, Kansas City, you've got Pat Mahomes, who's as good as it gets right now, and he's going to be the face of the league for a long time. And they can blow you away with one play. Tyreek Hill is as fast as anybody in the league. They can, as the saying goes, take the top off the defense. The 49ers are a little different in the sense that they run the ball. They've been great at that. But I think their offense, the 49er offense, is so varied. I look at the 49ers as a team coached by Kyle Shanahan, whose father, remember, won 2 Super Bowls back in the late 90s with the Denver Broncos. And I think Sports Illustrated had Mike either on the cover or in a featured story around that time, and they called him the mastermind. And I call Kyle Shanahan mastermind 2.0. They do a lot of motion and a lot of disguising. Their running game is great. But, you know, I think people are maybe not paying enough attention to how good Garoppolo really is. I've heard everybody say, well, you know, the 49ers, they don't need Garoppolo. I think he's pretty good, and I think if they need him to throw the ball, he's going to throw the ball very well. In fact, we had a couple of graphics on Sunday Night Football when we had the 49ers this year about this guy with selective amnesia. He throws an interception. And what happens after that? and we had a graphic that indicated that after he throws an interception for the next 15 or 20 passes, he has almost a perfect passer rating. So this guy is able to, you know, get rid of whatever whatever happened on a particular play, come back to the bench, and then, you know, come back out there, and he looks like, you know, an all-star quarterback at that point. But I think, you know, if I look at this game, I mean, it's pretty simple when you look at it. I think the 49ers have the better defense. They really got, you know, they were great at the beginning of the season, began to leak a little bit. Now they're good again on that side of the ball. I think their pass rush is tremendous. So I think if the 49ers can control the clock, if they run the ball, and remember, if you run the ball, you take a lot of time off the clock. You keep the ball out of Patrick Mahomes' hands, and that gives them, I think, the best chance to win the game. For Kansas City, if Mahomes has a big day, they're going to be very tough to beat.
We played a couple of clips a couple minutes ago of some chemo. What are moments that just excited you in the booth that you were, as you were calling? I mean, what moments did kind of electrify you and turned you into both a professional but also a fan of the game in the moment during a past Super Bowl?
Well, I mean, you actually, you know, you had the clips of three of Malcolm Butler's interception at the end of the game a few years ago between New England and Seattle. Another one that I called back in the late 90s was Tennessee against St. Louis when Kurt Warner came out of nowhere. The Rams had been 4-12 the year before. Warner takes over in 99 after Trent Green gets hurt in training camp. They have the greatest show on turf, as they called it at that time. And that's a game that ended at the half-yard line where Steve McNair throws a pass to Kevin Dyson. And if Dyson gets into the end zone to kick the extra point, that game goes to overtime. And instead, Mike Jones comes out of nowhere, makes a tremendous tackle at the half-yard line. That was great. To this day, I don't think anybody in Buffalo forgives me because I'm the guy that called Scott Norwood's miss back at the Giants Bills Super Bowl in 1990. No good wide right. Otherwise,
I remember
The Bills win the Super Bowl. You know, and they would go on to lose four Super Bowls in a row. So that game, and then the Arizona Pittsburgh game back in 2008 was tremendous as well. Where the Arizona Cardinals, who'd been beaten something like 50-0 by New England in week, you know, 14 or 15, what are they doing in the Super Bowl? But they get there. Larry Fitzgerald had a tremendous postseason. Kurt Warner is their quarterback at that particular point, and they actually have the lead with 2.5 minutes to go. And Ben Roethlisberger leads the Steelers back down the field at the end of the game. Hits Santonio Holmes with a pass in the corner of the end zone. That's also the game that featured a 100-yard interception run back by James Harrison at the end of the half. So instead of Arizona going into halftime with the lead, the next thing you know, it's 21-10 in favor of Pittsburgh because Harrison somehow, some way, is able to run 100 yards down the sideline, stay in bounds as the clock runs out at the end of the half. I mean, to me, that was just an epic play. And I know the NFL Network did the top whatever number of plays in the history of football, but boy, as far as I'm concerned, that's as good as it got.
You know, it was you are known for doing other things as well. You know, you called the 1989 World Series where there was an earthquake and you sort of kept your calm and cool and talked about that. You also, 40 years ago next month, with the great Ken Dryden, were broadcasting the Miracle on Ice, the victory of the U.S. Men's hockey team in the 1980 Winter Olympics against the Russian team. How do you as an announcer realize that you're going to be transcending the game itself? And when do you stay rooted in the moment?
You know, David, that's interesting because that was 1980. So there are no home VCRs. There's no internet. Cable television was in its infancy. So we were living in such a different time. So at that particular point, I'm not thinking about saying anything or announcing the game for posterity. I'm just announcing that game in the moment. And that was so crazy that night. The place is going wild. I mean, it was only a 7,000, 7,500-seat field house in which that game was being played.
Such an upset.
It was rocking. Of course, it was Sports Illustrated ranked it as the greatest sports moment of the 20th century, at least for the United States. I'm not sure the Soviets would necessarily have agreed with that ranking. but that was a case of just being intensely aware of calling the game, just calling the game, not going anyplace else, but the game. And remember, that's a game that's a one-goal game. The U.S. had come from behind three different times. The Soviets kept putting enormous pressure on the United States. And if the game had climaxed with a Soviet goal to tie the game, and I'm thinking about saying something for posterity, I mean, how stupid would that have sounded? So I got fortunate in that game in the sense that as the Soviets are putting pressure on the Americans and the U.S. is able to clear the puck out to center ice with about 5 or 6 seconds to go, and the word that came into my head was miraculous. And then miraculous got morphed into me saying, do you believe in miracles? Yes, and just leaving it at that. But at that point, I mean, I was just, that was coming out of my heart. That was what I felt emotionally. It was a miracle. It was a sports miracle. And I'm not thinking about, you know, 40 years later, people are going to play this thing back. Because as I say, you didn't have a tape machine at home. Now everything you say gets played back 18 million times on a loop. But it was a different time, a different era.
And you're being fed things.
It might have been 500 years ago.
Yeah, presumably you were being fed things on your iPhone or through your wire in your ear from your producer. This, you're really just doing it in real time. It's not that you're thinking about it. It's that you're feeling about it.
Right. Look, the great thing about sports, it's unscripted. It's happening.
Yep.
You have to be in the moment and describe what it's like at that particular moment, because this is not, it's not scripted television. And if you think of something beforehand, that I know ever since that time, I've talked to, other announcers, younger guys who, especially like back in the late 90s, a couple of guys who had an opportunity to maybe be there when either Mark McGwire or Sammy Sosa broke Roger Maris's yep. home run record, and they wanted to know, what would I be thinking about? And I said to them, hey, just, you have to describe what you see. It's as simple as that.
Do you believe in Al Michaels? I do. Al Michaels of NBC Sports, thanks so much for joining us today.
You bet, David. Take care. Have a good weekend.
We're drawing X and O's for you, and our radio telestrator for the Super Bowl kicks up Sunday night in Miami. Which team's captured your loyalty? Which do you think has the edge? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're looking ahead to Super Bowl Sunday and previewing the big game. You can join our conversation. Who are you pulling for between the Chiefs and the Niners? Who do you root for? The players, the coaches, or the teams? Follow us on the Twitters and the Facebook at On Point Radio. With me here in studio in New York City, Pablo Torre. He's co-host of ESPN's daytime show High Noon, also a columnist for ESPN.com. Pablo, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Thank you.
Joining us now from Miami as well, Charles Davis. He's game analyst for the NFL on Fox. On Sunday, he'll be calling the international broadcast of the Super Bowl for Fox. Charles, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it.
Guys, I want to start off maybe, Charles, let's do it. Let's break down these two teams, the style of play, the strengths, the relative. Let's start with the Chiefs, Charles. Tell me a little bit about where they stand out, how they got here, and how they developed into it.
Well, it's really pretty simple for them. They were able to find a transcendent quarterback named Patrick Mahomes. And I know there's more to it than that, but that's an incredible starting point. And they were good before he got there. Remember, Alex Smith was their quarterback. They were going to the playoffs. But this kid allows you to dream bigger, and he was better than what people ranked him coming out of college. And they are the most high-octane offense, most varied offense in the league right now. His right arm, great receivers who can fly, and a tight end who's the second team all pro behind the guy from San Francisco. They've got by the name of Travis Kelce. And defensively, they've gotten better. And they brought in Tyrann Mathieu for veteran leadership and Chris Jones up front. He breaks people down. This team is fun to watch. And Patrick Mahomes, he's flat out a rock star.
Charles, Mahomes, if I remember correctly, came out of Texas Tech, right? And he,
yes,
you talk about it, you talk of his right arm, and you talk, I mean, my sense is he's also has incredible spatial intelligence and really can kind of see where people are and where they're going. A lot of people watch the Super Bowl who don't follow the game super closely week after week, as well as everybody who does, right? So explain what makes him different as a quarterback. What makes him stand out, where he's special and what he can create or conjure up that maybe the more mortal starring quarterback might not be able to do?
Oh, well, could I go back to what you said before? And
sure.
I think that you nailed it. His spatial awareness And I liken him to Wayne Gretzky, because we always heard about Wayne Gretzky as a hockey player, that he always ended up where the puck was going, not where the puck was. And he learned that from his father, Walter, as a young boy who would send the puck around the boards or send it across ice and make him think the game ahead. If you watch Patrick Mahomes play, he will throw a ball places that you don't see a target, and then a receiver appears. He throws it to a place that draws receivers to it, but he throws it to the open spot because he's thinking ahead. So I think that you absolutely nailed what makes him special, besides obviously his right arm and his great athletic gifts. That brain of his is ahead of the game and ahead of the process.
Pablo Torre, does that sound about right to you?
His arm, I don't know if hyperbole is even possible when talking about that thing, man. When you watch the Chiefs play, what's so fascinating to me, as someone who is always on my couch on Sunday watching as much as I can, he throws the ball downfield. And the way you watch it on television, it's like you're spinning a globe. You don't know when the camera is going to stop panning. And you're like, okay, well, clearly it has to stop here. No, oh, it's still going. And Mahomes reaches them all the way downfield. So it's this intercontinental ballistic missile of an arm. And Charles, you know this. It's the accuracy, man. He can fling that thing off of the wrong foot going backwards with that arm and hit them in stride. And it's like – and the question really is for people who follow this stuff, who has been better than this? And I think there's a debate there, but you're not wrong if you say it's him.
Let me say this, though. Like, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Charles.
No, I was just going to say, Pablo, so many things you've said are to me perfectly on target. And when you say who's done it better – in our sports world, we value longevity, right? So we're very careful, even in this hot take era, we're very careful to anointing people the best we've ever seen until it's been done over time. Well, he's well on his way to doing that, but have we seen people with his gifts? The argument remains, and Pablo laid it out perfectly, and he is very much like Kevin Costner said in Bull Durham about Nuke LaLoosh. The Greek gods came down and put a thunderbolt in that arm that the rest of the people just don't have. And that's what he has, but he knows how to use it quite well.
That movie's a little bit like a sports Talmud for me. I mean, so much wisdom to extract, right? You know, the funny thing is, like, I worked for the Baltimore Sun for 10 years. And so when my Rams moved from Southern California, where I'm from, away to St. Louis
Me too.
And they kind of, you know, my family a little bit jarred in our football loyalty. So I tracked what the Ravens were doing. I thought Lamar Jackson was going to be the standout this year. I thought he was going to be the guy in the Super Bowl. I was convinced that he, as much as I think, oh, Patrick Mahomes is really incredible. He'll be incredible for years. I thought Lamar Jackson was the sensation.
I was with you. And watching Lamar Jackson, what was different about Lamar, and this was the year of Lamar until about, I don't know, now 3 to 4 weeks ago.
Right.
What Lamar did was
the
sort
bye
of...
bye week.
Yeah, right. But what Lamar was doing was forcing you to reimagine what a quarterback was expected to do. So Mahomes, like, he is sort of living and fulfilling and exceeding this paradigm of a passer. Lamar Jackson could pass, and so much of the criticism he got was unfair and unfounded, especially now in retrospect around his passing ability. But what they were doing on the ground, that's where the conversation in sports turned to, are we going to get more of these guys? Mm-hmm. And immediately the answer was, on the one hand, no, because Lamar Jackson is, you know, singular. But on the other hand, if you could find people to replicate that kind of ambition, it's pretty clear that the Ravens figured out something, except it turned out to be for the second straight year, the year of Patrick Mahomes.
So let's talk about Mahomes and then talk about him in terms of the Niners. He talked he's not only a starting quarterback, he's the NFL's reigning MVP. He spoke with the NFL Network on Monday about the distinct challenges that he perceived were presented by the defense of the San Francisco 49ers.
They have a great defensive line, and they're really good at pressuring the quarterback and stripping the ball from the quarterback and doing all those things. And so for me, it's about kind of weathering the storm, not trying to do anything crazy, just do what I've been doing, get the ball out of my hands. And the good thing about this offense is we have a good offensive line, and then I have a lot of receivers. If I can just get it to them in space, they can score touchdowns.
So Mahomes is only the third quarterback to win an MVP and play in the Super Bowl in his first 3 years of an NFL career. He joins Dan Marino of the Miami Dolphins, Kurt Warner of the Rams in St. Louis as the other two. How accurately, Charles Davis, is Mahomes capturing the challenge that he faces there? Talk to us a little bit about the Niners defense and why they're so crackerjack.
Yeah, he's captured it perfectly because what he's talking about, that ball being out of his hands quickly into his receiver so they can be in space. Well, the being in space is yet to be determined. Depends on what kind of a coverage they'll face and whether they can win against that defense. The ball out of his hands is real because if you go back and watch the Niners, I think that Drew Brees and the Saints gave the Chiefs a great blueprint. If you go back midseason, it's a 48-46 game. San Francisco won it. All right, people remember George Kittle's big play down the stretch where he's running with his face mask being tugged on. But throughout the game, if you watch Drew Brees, the way he kept that rush tamped down and kept them at bay, the ball was out of his hands very quickly into the hands of receivers and let them do the creating downfield. That was a big, big deal. That way you don't have to count on your offensive line, no matter how much faith you have in them, to try and hold off Nick Bosa, Dee Ford, DeForest Buckner, Eric Armstead, and the rest of that like. Because when they brought beat on a quarterback, they are awfully impressive. But the ball's out of your hands, then they can't get to them, and you're hoping to hold them off that way. I think he's got the perfect blueprint for it, and he has the right receiving cadre to do that. Because those guys are awfully quick downfield. They win at the line of scrimmage, and he's got a tight end in Travis Kelce that can make a lot of plays close to the line of scrimmage and downfield.
48-46, it sounds more like a college basketball game or an S&P index fund or something. Yeah, that's a lot of points.
That wide receiver group is built like a college basketball team. You know, you've got your point guard, you've got your two guard, you've got your power forward, you've got your center. And nowadays in college basketball, there aren't many centers, are there? It's all forwards and guards playing the game. That's how they are built. And the other part is they're also a track squad. They can absolutely fly.
Yeah, that's the metaphor that I would seize on. They have size, absolutely, Charles, but it's the Olympic track team kind of stuff that I've talked to defensive backs, retired now, and they're glad they're out of the game because this just seems impossible. And so to your point, what do you do if you're the Niners? Well, the key as always is to get as much pressure up front so that you put pressure on Pat Mahomes such that he has less time to sort of wind up and throw. So it really is this sort of precision timing mechanism where if you can get pressure with four guys up front, and the 49ers, to their credit, are better at that than anyone else in football, then you have a shot at disrupting what the Chiefs are going to do to you. But you mentioned Andy Reid, the coach of this team. Like, that dude, for as much as he is this Wilford Brimley type of character who's known for like mismanaging clock and not winning a Super Bowl, what he is with Pat Mahomes, he's an oracle. And he has seen the progression and the evolution of NFL offenses. And in this collection of offensive talent in Travis Kelce, it's weird to mention him like third or fourth on this list of people. Tyreek Hill, the fastest guy we've seen in the NFL, maybe. He has exactly the toys that you would dream about.
You know, you mentioned the idea of the track team, right? My mind flashes back as Southern California, and I think about legendary Niners teams like Joe Montana and John Taylor, these other phenomenal wide receivers, tight ends that could fly, right? And yet, you know, this generation, a completely different thing. You know, the Niners rebuilt, you know, they had a real fallow period there for a while, but the Niners rebuilt not only post-Montana, and we should note that Montana, of course, went on to play with the Chiefs as well, as did Steve Young for both teams, but that they rebuilt post-Kaepernick. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit, Pablo Torre, about Kaepernick and thinking about him as a figure in the Niners, a figure who was a pretty decent quarterback, you know, a guy who seemed to me to be a legit starter in this league for sure, and what happened with the political disputes and what happened in terms of them having to pick up and figure out how they rebuild the team.
Colin Kaepernick made it to a Super Bowl.
I mean,
Colin Kaepernick,
he's the real thing.
He is the real thing. And the conversation around him is so deep and so polarizing. And I hate that word polarizing, but I truly don't know a better
fraught.
Yeah, fraught. And it's because what he is, David, is a messenger that people who don't care at all about the message love to obsess about. And so for me, right, what is the legacy of Colin Kaepernick? Well, he started a conversation around police brutality and institutional racism that ended with him being shut out of the league. But the degree to which he is relevant today and is in the news cycle seemingly semi-regularly because of the way the NFL has mishandled his case, it speaks to the fact that in this country, man, we love to attack messengers. We love it when there are reasons and exit ramps away from Colin Kaepernick's actual message. And for him, the fascinating part about the football aspect, to get back to that now, like, could he be a starting quarterback in the league right now is kind of this open debate. And for me,
a lot of teams out there.
There are a lot of bad quarterbacks out there.
Right.
And so it's like, maybe. But it's that sort of thought experiment that keeps us arguing about him over and over again, even as the 49ers obviously have found not just a successor in Jimmy Garoppolo, but success as a team after him.
And Charles Davis, I want to play for you a clip.
Yeah.
4 years ago, of course, Kaepernick began kneeling on sidelines during the national anthem of games to protest police brutality toward African Americans. The movement split players and management, proved divisive, as Pablo just said. Also heartfelt by many stars. This Sunday, this NFL will air a pro-social justice Super Bowl ad that directly addresses the issue. Here you'll hear retired Baltimore Ravens player Anquan Boldin describing the death of his cousin, Corey Jones, who was shot and killed in 2015 by a Florida police officer.
There's just some things that are bigger than football. And I felt like starting the Players Coalition and affecting change in this country was one of those things.
We focused on police community relations, education and economic advancement, and criminal justice reform. Had it not been for the work that we do, Corey's death would have been in vain. The best way to inspire change is to be it.
The ad is part of the NFL's Inspire Change initiative aimed at promoting awareness of social justice issues. Charles Davis, where is the league on this now? And how has that shifted from when Kaepernick first took a knee?
Yeah, I think what has happened is the league got the message, but they, and I think Pablo expressed it very well, the messenger got left behind because the people that they are promoting, when I say promoting, the people like, you know, Anquan Boldin, who's a tremendous man and has an incredible story, Malcolm Jenkins in Philadelphia, a number of people are doing a great job promoting the efforts for social justice and change. But nowhere will you see the league say, hey, remember Colin Kaepernick started us talking about this. It's like it never happened with him, because the league is also aware that during that time frame, many people didn't like the way that Colin Kaepernick brought the message across. When players started kneeling, people took it, and you both have mentioned how the message got lost. The message wasn't ever against the flag and country and against the military. But people co-opted it and turned it into that and lost the message, and there became anger. How can you protest our military? How you're not – that was never the case. But now they're able to get the message across. No one's arguing that part. That's good for all of us. Mm-hmm. But Colin Kaepernick has been the one that's been lost. He's Kurt Flood for baseball. Kurt was protesting the reserve rule that the now we
agency.
Have free agency.
Yep.
But Kurt lost his career in doing that. Here's Colin Kaepernick, who's lost his career on a message that got co-opted incorrectly on his, by people, yet now we've embraced what he was trying to bring. I'll never forget, and I'll just be brief here, my father, who went to a historically black college university and played football and baseball, taught in segregated schools before losing his job when schools finally integrated with all deliberate speed, as we remember, Brown versus Board of Education. He told me the day that Colin Kaepernick kneeled and it became a cause célèbre, he told me that day he has started, he's going to start a conversation and he's going to have a message, but it will get lost because people won't understand it. And my dad nailed it.
You've been hearing there from Charles Davis. We're joined by Charles Davis, a game analyst for NFL on Fox, and Pablo Torre of ESPN. They're sticking with us. We're breaking down everything you need to know about the NFL and everything you need to know ahead of this weekend's Super Bowl between the San Francisco 49ers and the Kansas City Chiefs. You can join our conversation. Have your feelings about the Super Bowl changed over the years? And we're going to play us out of this segment with a song by one of the Super Bowl halftime show stars, Jennifer Lopez, and her song Jenny from the Block. That's her 2002 hit that's among the betting favorites to be heard on Sunday. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
You get is what you see.
Don't be fooled by the rocks that I got. I'm still Jenny from the block. Used to have a little, now I have a lot. No matter where I go, I know where I came from. Don't be fooled by the rocks that I got. I'm still Jenny from the block. Used to have a little, now I have a lot. No matter where I go, I know where I came from.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. The NFL season concludes on Sunday with Super Bowl 54 between the San Francisco 49ers and the Kansas City Chiefs. We're setting the table, putting out the guac, and hunting for the remote. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me here in studio, Pablo Torre. He's co-host of ESPN's daytime show, High Noon. And with us from Miami, Florida, Charles Davis, game analyst for the NFL on Fox on Sunday. He'll be calling the international broadcast of the Super Bowl for that network. Usually there's about a huge seven-day media craziness that attends this game, Pablo Torre. And yet I felt it was understandably dampened and diminished by conversation about Kobe Bryant's tragic death last Sunday. It seemed to me to be felt deeply across the world of sports. Throughout this week, players from a lot of different sports professions have shared their memories of Kobe and what they describe as his attitude of perseverance and on-court courage that he called his Mamba mentality. The first voice you'll hear to belongs to star 49ers cornerback Richard Sherman. The second is Chiefs running back Darwin Thompson.
You know, I saw him make two free throws and walk off with a torn Achilles. And once I tore mine, I knew I had to walk off.
He had that Mamba mentality, and he taught me that. I mean, just the way he played the game, the effort he put into it, the drive and determination to be the greatest player. Kobe Bryant, man.
Pablo Torre, how does Kobe Bryant's death affect the sphere of professional athletics?
He was a philosophy. He wasn't just the guy who was trying to be the next Michael Jordan, and that conversation will be debated in barbershops for the rest of time. But what he was, David, was a guy who embodied what honestly felt within the NBA like a football mentality. This whole notion of, I am going to outwork everybody. I'm going to sacrifice my body. I'm going to find greatness almost deliberately through misery. I mean, he talked about his life and approach to sports. He used terms like a dark muse cage. That was the kind of guy he was, which means that he needed to get in touch with darkness to be great. He was somebody who contemplated mortality all of the time. Like, he was obsessed with Achilles, the Greek warrior who was fated to be famous forever but die young. So for him, I can think of few people who wasted less time that they were gifted on this planet than Kobe Bryant, and he was the embodiment of that, especially within sports.
Was that I grew up a Lakers fan, and I followed him even as an adult. Was that informed? It seemed to me there was kind of a pivot, like the darkness you talk about, at least as publicly articulated, really came after the accusation that he experienced in his, I guess, early mid-20s when he was rehabbing. Colorado was accused of rape, faced criminal charges. Those were dropped when the woman declined to testify. But he offered an unusually full apology, acknowledging that she felt that the encounter was not consensual. And then there was an undisclosed settlement paid later on to settle her civil suit, which is clearly a cloud that, you know, cast over him, and we have to acknowledge as we think about his life. Do you identify what you've described as sort of him tapping into the question of darkness as a transition from that period, or do you think those are two unrelated
I think elements? He made them related, and I think there is certainly the sense that Kobe was as hard a worker as anyone from day one. But, and this is part of the discomfort around talking about this, he also branded himself as such when he embraced and leaned into the notion of being a villain. And that's a big distinction from him and, say, Jordan or even the other greats in sports. There are very few heroes that willingly own up to that label of villain, and that was not coincidentally intersecting with a time when advertisers and marketers stepped away from him. And he was a guy getting booed for reasons both superficial and substantive. So it is a fascinating story of, honestly, like a guy who always controlled his own narrative.
I want to turn now back to thinking a little bit about the NFL. You think about narratives there. Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, likes to give what I guess he calls the state of the NFL, the state of the league address, Charles Davis. And there's a number of things sort of on the plate. How has the NFL done the last couple of years under Goodell? Where does it stand as it enters this triumphal game and moment? I mean, we've thought a lot about head injuries in recent years, questions of draining popularity with younger players, and yet this is still the apex of watching sports on TV and of national participation, right? Where do things stand?
I think things are better for the NFL, guys. And the reason I say that is part of what you've already brought up, David. The state of the NFL a couple of years ago was players kneeling, fans saying they weren't going to come to the stadium anymore. I'm not going to watch it on TV. Understandably upset at what they perceived, not being in concert with our country. Too many head injuries of many families making the decision, my kids are not going to play this sport anymore. Right on down the line. Well, they've worked harder on the head injuries. The rules have changed. How we're playing the game has been changed. They're doing a better job with protective gear, trying to get better helmets on people, amongst other things. And when you couple it with the fact that they weathered that storm and now it feels like that's beyond them. We talked about the social justice before. Those commercials are out there now. Who's against people doing all the right things and being taken care of? Not many people. They're okay with that. That's benign enough in how it's coming across to people that now people are feeling comfortable again. And the game also has a bunch of stars in it that people grasp onto, not the least of which is Patrick Mahomes, who we'll see on Sunday. So I feel like they're in a much better place than they were before. But I also think that Roger Goodell and the league will remain vigilant because that process started with CTE, the head injuries. Are they losing players? Are enough players playing across the country to continue to fuel and fill the NFL? They're not in a critical stage yet, but they'll have to remain on that course and continue to try to make the game safer, even though we'll never make it entirely safe. That's a big deal for the league and for the commissioner.
As well as the players on the field, and we'll be talking more about them in a moment.
Yes.
Some notable developments off them. Katie Sowers is an offensive assistant coach for the San Francisco 49ers. On Sunday, she'll become the first female and the first openly gay coach to work in the Super Bowl. Here's a snippet of a Microsoft commercial that features Sowers that's going to air during the game.
I'm Katie Sowers, offensive assistant coach for the San Francisco 49ers.
Bring it up.
I always knew I wanted to be a coach. My dad was a coach. I never saw an opportunity in football because I'd never seen a female coach before.
Let's run it again. Let's go.
People tell me that people aren't ready to have a woman lead, but these guys have been learning from women their whole lives. Moms, grandmas, teachers.
Then the shovel comes as a first read.
We have all these assumptions about what women do in life and what men do.
I'm glad my daughter's old enough to see this and understand how significant it is.
I'm not trying to be the best female coach. I'm trying to be the best coach.
So they're an advance for women, for gays in professional football. We have a call now from Joel, who's been waiting for a moment. Appreciate you waiting. Appreciate your listening. Joel's calling us from Vancouver, Washington. Thanks for calling in, Joel. What are you thinking about all this?
Hello. I was listening to the program, and I was listening to the comments about as related to Colin Kaepernick and how social issues are interacting with the NFL. And I guess this is unfortunately particularly apt here because there's so much emphasis on the athleticism and the commitment of the players, which is impressive. At the same time, what that tends to roll over is the darker side. And unfortunately, one aspect of the game, when we talk about, is highlighted in this week's game, we talk about Colin Kaepernick not being able to get a quarterback job because the league deems him to be a distraction. But somehow Tyreek Hill, with a record of charges of sexual assault against his girlfriend and his son, isn't deemed a distraction. A Richie Incognito isn't deemed a distraction despite a record of infractions that could go on forever. The league has a terrible record in promoting African-Americans to head coaching positions despite the fact that 70% of the players are African-American. So that's what I think about, and that's what continues year after year, month after month, season after season, to get displaced because we're so intoxicated with what happens on the field. And that was my comment, and I'll take my response off the air.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thanks for listening, Joel, and thanks for chipping that in. Pablo Torre, way in here. There's this thing called the Rooney Rule, which is designed to try to get teams to interview candidates of color who could be head coaches. How's the team doing on that? What do you make of that?
The league is doing terribly, and the rule should exist. It must exist, and there are tweaks that you could make around the rule to expand it. Maybe let's have it for coordinators, for instance, such that the pipeline of people who have the background conventionally expected of coaches is diversified. But to me, the core issue is that team owners and front offices in the NFL, they don't see it or don't see it enough as a rule that exists in their self-interest. That's what's wild to me. It's not that you're forced to do this. You're not forced to, I got to meet this obligation at work. It's why don't you consider the fact that there is a massive inefficiency that is, in fact, race. Why aren't you looking at black and Hispanic candidates more closely? Simply because maybe the people outside of what some would deem your natural social networks, maybe those people, as they are in every field, as they are in the very study of biology, adding something by virtue of diversity. It's just something that is so illogical to me on top of the whole twist my arm to be a good person thing.
So if I'm not mistaken, the Chiefs offensive coordinator is Eric Bieniemy, is African-American. Niners defensive coordinator Robert Saleh interviewed with the Browns. Bieniemy was interviewed with several teams. So you have two top performing – I mean they're in the Super Bowl, right? They're the top deputy coaches, both passed over at least so far for head coaching jobs this year.
Yeah, and Eric Bieniemy is now – every year it seems like there's a face of the guy who has been snubbed. And that is Bieniemy. And all of the stuff we said earlier in this show about that Chiefs offense – he's the guy at the controls. And the fact that he doesn't have a job yet, it continues to mystify me.
Want to take another call from Richmond, Virginia. Ishmael, thanks for weighing in here. What are your thoughts? Ishmael, you with us?
Proud of, yes, I am.
Go ahead, sir.
I'm particularly proud of the story of the Kansas City Chiefs' investment in African-American players from early on, getting players like Willie Lanier from historically black schools, but always having a distinctive crop of African-American players that have shown that there is an excellence, that investment in African-American excellence can reap the benefit of going to a Super Bowl. It's a simple story, but I think it needs to be told and inspiring other young people that you can make it, you know, and that there are organizations that are willing to see the value in hosting African-American and other people of color to build their excellence in their organizations.
Well, thank you for that, Ishmael. I appreciate it very much. Let's turn to the game and what's happening on the field once more before we close out the hour, guys. It strikes me, you know, we shouldn't ignore the saga and the challenges of Jimmy Garoppolo, you know, who is a guy who was seen as the not just the backup, but the ultimate replacement for Tom Brady, perhaps the greatest quarterback of all time for the New England Patriots. And, you know, Brady wanted to stick around and suddenly Garoppolo was no more. He struck me. I thought this guy was going to light up the scoreboard and torch the stats. And then there was a guy who in recent games, it seemed as though, you know, Mahomes could throw more in a quarter than you'd see Garoppolo throw in a game. Charles Davis, how good is Garoppolo and how important is he to the team, or is he along for the ride a little bit like Trent Dilfer was in that first Ravens Super Bowl team?
Yeah, I'm going to answer that, but very quickly, that call from Ishmael.
Yes, sir.
Terrific history of Kansas City doing what he was talking about. Lloyd Wells was their scout, a black man that they hired as a scout early, who scouted those historically black colleges and universities and signed the core of their first Super Bowl team to be those players, the Willie Laniers, the Emmett Thomases, you know, that Buck Buchanan, that crew. That's what the caller was talking about. Now we've got to advance that record on coaches and front office people and continue to work in that direction. But for Jimmy Garoppolo, look, he is overlooked because San Francisco's been running over people with the football. All right? But Pablo, have you seen the likes of this in the playoffs? They ran over a Minnesota Vikings defense that's one of the proudest in the league and one of the best in the league. Just stuffed it down their throat running the ball. Green Bay knew it was coming, had no answer for it whatsoever. Now you come up against Kansas City, who struggled throughout the year up until about the last 5, 6, 7 games versus the run. They did their best job versus Derrick Henry last week. I mean, 2 weeks ago. But bottom line is they're going to get tested that way. But for those who think Jimmy Garoppolo can't throw the football, they need to turn on some game tape because he got it done during the year. Over 4,000 yards throwing it. The game in New Orleans, when they needed him to throw the ball, he threw it very effectively. Late in the season, they needed a last drive against the Rams. He threw it effectively. At your own peril, do you think Jimmy Garoppolo can't throw the football? They just haven't needed him to. I don't think he's going to throw it only 8 times in this one. I think he's going to be throw it a lot more. And I think that he has a chance to be very effective in doing so because Kansas City is going to be masked against the run. But anyone who thinks they're doing it because he can't play, they're missing the message. Well, they're doing it because they'll be able to run over people right now. If they need him to throw it, Garoppolo is more than capable.
What do you say, Pablo?
I've seen nothing like this, Charles. And what the 49ers do, they just run until someone stops them. And no one has stopped them. And so in Jimmy Garoppolo, you have this guy who, look, there are like 3 stats that I think a lot of people consider to be pretty telling about a quarterback. One is touchdown passes. One is completion percentage. The other one is yards per attempt. Jimmy Garoppolo is the only quarterback in the league to be top 5 in all 3 categories. So he has talent. It's just that they haven't needed him, as you say, to be that talented.
All right, so you're hearing what should be a matchup between an irresistible force and, I don't know the other side of it anymore. So, someone that would stop it. Immovable object. Thank you, sir. Charles Davis bailing me out, game analyst for the NFL on Fox. Thanks for joining, Charles. Look forward to hearing you on the international broadcast at Super Bowl on Sunday. And we've had here in studio with us here in New York, Pablo Torre. He's co-host of ESPN's daytime show, High Noon, and columnist for ESPN.com. Thanks.
Thank you.
You continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on the Twitters, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm David Folkenflik. You've been listening to On Point.